This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello, and welcome to Art at the End of the World, the podcast where we welcome artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. And my name is Mark Wigmore. Welcome to the season two finale of the show, Art at the End of the World. And I have to say, over the last week or two, promoting the podcast, whether it be here or online or on the air at the New Classical FM where I work, it's felt a little awkward, to be honest, chatting up the brand. I am not trying to make things worse, I promise. But you wouldn't be the first person to tell me that the moniker is hitting a little close to home these days, a little close to the bone. But at any rate, I certainly hope you're holding up and staying safe. And I know some science leaders have suggested, imagine you have COVID-19, the virus, and how you would interact in the world knowing that. So that is the mind shift, I suppose, we have to think about going forward. Anyway, all the best to you. And how glad am I that we managed to sneak in this interview with legendary singer-songwriter Gordon Lightfoot before the door was shut on such meetings and ideas. And doors have been shut really all over the city. State of emergency called over the last week in Toronto and Ontario, other places within the country, certainly in BC. Gordon and I met at the Warner offices north of the city about a week or so ago. And even then, he was fist bumping, no hugs or anything like that, just to be cautious. His lovely wife was there as well. And it's a bit of a wild and meandering conversation, but I'm very happy that it happened. And really, how incredible to get a chance to speak with a guy who's part of the pantheon of singer-songwriters from the late 60s and 70s, and very special for our last episode this season. I came up with the title for this podcast as I was walking through the forest one day, a couple years back now. And at the time, I was feeling overwhelmed. And I think at the moment, I would say it was the cultural changes we were going through. Me Too, creating quite a stir through the arts world, changing distribution systems for art, what that meant for the livelihoods of artists, changing politics, nationalism, xenophobia on the rise. And really, I personally was just trying to get a toehold during an age of outrage and echo chambers and Twitter. And that was the thinking. That was what inspired the title. It just sort of popped into my brain. And so this moment, where we're seeing an actual health scare, a pandemic, is really beyond anything I ever imagined. And how quickly it has dominated the news cycle and daily life is really nothing short of breathtaking, staggering, really. And so many of the artists that have appeared on this show or who I've spoken to on my radio programs, they're in a real quagmire right now. And that goes for all the industries that are public and require groups of people to function. And so we're thinking about you right now. If you're one of those people trying to figure out the next move, trying to put together your finances. But honestly, my heart goes out as well to all the artists, the hardworking artists who help to create empathy in this world and who give context and reflect our experiences in ways that make us better people for witnessing their perspectives. And I personally will make it my mission to continue to support you and get the word out as much as I can in the weeks to come on my show, The Oasis, on the New Classical FM. And we are starting to book artists and interviews on the show again, many of them on the phone for the time being. And we are looking at what's happening next for with this podcast. So I'm with you. We are with you. And hopefully we can all work together to see some light at the end of the tunnel. Two companies I know are affected by the coronavirus are sponsors of this very podcast, and this is not how I wanted to say thank you on our final episode of season two, with doors closed and contracts being put on hold, but when we get back to business in our next season, I will be sure to remind you of how great it was to work with Crow's Theater over this last 10 episodes, one of this country's most acclaimed arts organizations based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. Crow's Theater, creating unforgettable theater that examines and illuminates the pivotal narratives of our times. How important is that right now? Crowstheater.com for info on what's happening with them currently and into next season. The company located, by the way, at Carlaw and Dundas, and when it's safe to do so in the months to come, you should go see a show there. And thanks again to Suzanne and the team at Red Eye Media. Suzanne, you have been such a champion of this podcast. Thank you. It means so much. And Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company, working with award-winning clients, including the Musical Stage Company, Summerworks Performance Festival, Crow's Theater, and many others. To learn more, redeyemedia.ca. And hopefully we are going to do this again, this podcast. So if you want to come on board and be a sponsor, we've had several companies come to us just over the last couple weeks asking to be a part of the next season. Please do get in touch. You can find us at artattheendoftheworld.com. I want to take a moment and thank you for all the notes and emails over the last couple weeks. We've had numerous people ask why I called the podcast Art at the End of the World. Am I somehow psychic? I hope I answered that question earlier, but it was not some sort of marketing stunt. I can tell you that. It was just an honest sense of where we are and where artists are and the challenges that we're facing this moment, and really a way to talk about a lot of the issues and have the thoughts of artists underlined with a new platform. But thank you for all the notes. Thank you for everybody who's come on board and started listening over this last 10 or 20 episodes here. We also heard from so many people who enjoyed Carolyn Taylor from Baroness Von Sketch, our guest last week. And you can listen to all the episodes free of charge, the brand new episodes and the remix episodes from the first season. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, please do subscribe to Art at the End of the World. All right, here we go.
I can see her lying back in her satin dress, in her room where you do what you don't confess. Sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back stairs, sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back stairs.
Well, you know that voice, Gordon Lightfoot. Where do you even start with this man? Beyond just a great songwriter, just part of the ether, part of the cultural fabric. I was watching the film Knives Out the same night that I interviewed Gordon Lightfoot, and right there in the soundtrack, one of his songs, Serendipitous. The man is just woven into popular music at this point. I remember, I think my mom will have to get back to me on this, but Mom, maybe you remember, I think there was a copy of Gord's Gold. It was that double album in my parents' record collection. And I remember listening to that record. It was probably the first chance I had to hear his songs. And even then, you know, you'd heard them on the radio, even though I was discovering vinyl, discovering music. I felt like, okay, I'm already familiar with these songs. Then I remember, you know, you sort of have the image of the younger Gordon Lightfoot. That was often the one that would be beamed at you. I remember seeing him in the fundraising music video, Tears Are Not Enough, with all those Canadian music stars back in the 80s. It was kind of a fun memory of Gord. That was all put into context when I got together with John Donaby, who was actually is one of the guests on this season. You can have a listen to it if you go back into the episodes. But we had Gordon on way back about 20 years ago. And John really set me straight. He sort of connected all the dots for me. And that's when it dawned on me, you know, back in the 90s, 2000s, how important Gordon Lightfoot is to the tapestry of music. And when you think about it, it's Bob Dylan. It's Joni Mitchell. It's Leonard Cohen. Maybe Neil Young. and Gordon Lightfoot. Those are the names. Those are the pillars of modern singer-songwriters that everybody can kind of go to and, you know, haul out the guitar around the campfire, and we know those songs. In fact, I can remember, and I think I'm going to bring this story up with Gordon, I can remember going to the Songwriters Hall of Fame and just lucky enough to be a fly on the wall right next to me in the next table while I was enjoying a cocktail. There was Gordon Lightfoot and Leonard Cohen having a conversation. I felt like I was seeing a dragon or something. It was an unbelievable moment, very special. He's a Governor General's Performing Arts Award winner, Order of Canada, of course. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. That's right, the big international one. The Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, of course. I was lucky enough to work at CBC Music for many years, and it was there that I really had a chance to start spinning the tunes and play Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, Early Morning Rain, Sundown, If You Could Read My Mind, Baby Step Back. I really like that one. And so this was just an unbelievable opportunity and chance to get to meet the man and have a conversation. His influence so vast, so many hits, so many great records, all the famous tours, all his time at the Mariposa Festival, his, I guess you could say, hundreds of concerts at Massey Hall, all the famous moments. And then there's been a real spotlight on him over the last few years. The new biography by Nicholas Jennings, not that new, but fairly new. You can read that. He, by the way, penned the new article in Zoomer Magazine about Gordon. There's the new documentary film, which you can catch if you could read my mind. So for this conversation, we met at Warner's, and I just tried to be open and follow along with what Gordon wanted to do. He's got this new record out, first record in 16 years. It's titled Solo, and we'll listen to a bit of that over the next hour as well. So here we go, our season finale with the legendary Gordon Lightfoot on Art at the End of the World.
It's so easy to live with no fear or deceit, but sometimes I think maybe I have skipped a beat. The road I chose was not all it should be, but sometimes it was oh so sweet.
Oh, let me go too deep.
Well, we'll see about that.
Who's the band that called themselves the Gretzky?
Yeah. Dwayne Gretzky?
They were damn good.
I hear they're damn good.
I mean, we worked with them. I heard them. We heard them playing in New York. We heard them.
Nice. You know what was a fun show was seeing Randy Bachman with the Sadies. Did you hear about those shows?
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I'm glad they got that together.
Yeah.
I mean, they were at my house all couple of days. They lost everything. All the fun that we had, they didn't get
on
it
on the cutting room floor.
Up in the cutting room floor.
You guys still get out to the wild? I know you did that for a long time. I don't know if you're still doing it.
No, I don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Those days are gone.
I don't do that no more.
I only ask because I recently came into a cabin. And so I'm cutting my teeth. I'm trying to learn to wear lumberjack outfits and use chainsaws and all these things, you know, get used to having moose swimming on my island and so on. All that stuff. It's fun, right?
Yeah. When you say it came into it, what did you buy it or did you inherit it?
Yeah, sort of inherited it. It was like a...
And then now it's your responsibility.
It is. Yeah, that's kind of how I inherited
so
it.
Congratulations.
Yeah, you're telling me.
It's, okay, well, that's good. So you got to work at that.
Yeah.
We were always moving day to day. You know,
you would fly up north. Is that what
we'd start? Some of our trips started at Yellowknife.
Nice.
We had one started once at Thompson, Manitoba. We had one start at Ross River in the Yukon one time. And I had another one start in northern Quebec. We started in Chibougamau. Couple of times.
What's the strangest sight you ever saw up there? It took you by surprise.
In the land of the midnight sun.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! The animals. The strangest. Well, the wildlife is always present and always. That was the part that I really liked. And
me too.
And we had some good photographers on some of these trips too, and they got some really good photography of wildlife photography.
Nice.
So it was mostly the traveling, and you know, what was not like, like people say, was it a hunting trip or a fishing trip? And we, nope.
It's so neither of those.
Did you have any guns in case there was bears? And no, we didn't carry any guns in case there were bears. We got to the point where we would carry an emergency locator transmitter with us, though.
That's a good idea.
And before that, a couple of times we went with a two-way radio, traveling in northern Quebec, and the guy that had the two-way radio, too, he also spoke both languages. And so every night when he did his transmission, we were on the Rupert River, he'd be able to do it in English and in French.
Yeah, yeah, that's handy. You got to have that. She's hiding behind the foosball table.
Are you there? Where the hell are
your
you?
Your wife is literally under the foosball table.
That's all. I didn't see you leave.
Nothing God, to see there.
Yeah, she's. I don't want to. I don't want to go too deep. It's good that she's here. Honestly, I get crazy.
You're a November 17th. I'm a November 14th.
Then you understand.
Did you ever buy into the Scorpio business?
Yes, I think I did.
You did?
Yeah, I think I did.
All the different chronicling of your life over the last 10 years.
That'll tell you, yeah.
There's some Scorpio there, I'd say, oh, don't
yeah.
you think?
Yeah, yeah. I was bad. I was bad. I created a lot of emotional stress and a lot of other people, too, other than just myself. But I didn't realize that I was doing that, of course. I always felt that I was innocent of inflicting my emotional stress upon others without realizing what I was doing, you know.
Was there some sort of a turning point, you know, a light that turned on where you thought the emotional maturity is finally here?
Well, I mean, my third marriage is pretty good, and, you know, a long time ago I gave up alcohol.
Right. That's a big one.
You know, so it's been, I've been sort of in a state of repentance for many years now, because once you get away from alcohol, I mean, it changes your whole outlook on life, and all of a sudden you lose weight, and you, after 2 or 3 months, you become a new person. You're buying new pants with a, where you go from like a 36 to a 34 inch waist. You know? At one time I was up to like 190 pounds, and now I'm back down to 130, and that's really good singing weight. I sing well at that weight, and also it suits my stage apparel too, because I have my own unique costuming.
You do.
Routine that I
I love it. There's a lot of different looks. Here's one right here. There you are on the cover of Zoomer. You like to have the belt hang down just a little.
Oh, there it is.
That's as it, we speak, man. It's like literally there. Yeah, it's on it. You as we speak.
Yeah, that's it.
So we're looking at the cover of Zoomer magazine. There you are. Brian Adams took that picture.
Well, Brian was at the house, too, and he's one of my favorite musicians. And it's the third time that he's photographed me. I said, why did you become a photographer? And he said, because the first time I picked up a camera, people started calling me. That was what he said. The calls started coming.
Right.
He said, I picked up the camera and the calls...
It's interesting.
From Zoomer were there too, and we had a great afternoon, lots of fun with them.
And you're looking dapper. It's a great photo shoot. Lots of different costumes, as you point out.
Well, that's in my house, and everybody was there.
Interesting about Brian Adams. I think about him sometimes. The way he treats his band is, I don't know that they do my understanding, anyways. I don't know that they do a ton of rehearsing. I think they have the songs, they have the hits, and they kind of get out there and do their thing when they go out on tour. That is, my understanding is that is the antithesis of how you operate. You run a pretty tight ship.
Yeah, we try to plan. You got to have a game plan going ahead.
Yeah.
And be ready for any eventuality. In July, I had a leg injury that had me laid up for 4 months, and we had to reorganize
everything. I read about it.
And all of
Nicholas Jennings says he couldn't unsee it.
Yeah, I mean, I fought my way through that one. We're okay now. We're back playing again, but that brought everything to a stop, like for 4 months. And
where does that perfectionism come from? People say perfectionist, meticulous, particular. You know, these are the words that get thrown around about your methods of maybe rehearsal and writing. Does that go all the way back to mom and dad? Where did that come from?
Probably back there.
Yeah.
We're doing so many shows that actually, lately we've been touring so much and everything like that, we haven't been doing too much rehearsing. So
when you're playing that much.
Yeah, sometimes we just rehearse one or two at a time.
Now. Right.
Well, I still practice it all the time.
I know you do.
I have to practice. I don't mind practicing, but I do. I do have to practice guitar.
Yeah.
Every time I think of practicing, it takes me my mind into another
Well, it's how it works, right?
I've even got a method for everything. I've got a method even for practicing.
Yeah.
I love to watch sports games on TV and practice while I'm watching the game on TV. I don't go to very many games, but I love watching all the games.
You ever play along with the commercials?
No, I could practice through a commercial or two.
Yeah.
But you're watching a game and you're practicing at the same time. It's kind of, it makes sort of sense.
It's meditative somehow.
Yeah, you're getting ready just like they have to be.
Yeah.
You're getting ready. they were ready to play, and now they're playing, and you think they'd be ready to play.
Yeah.
You know,
that's right. So, you hope. Some of them more
so
than others.
We.
Yeah.
We have to be like that all the time, and there's our family lives. There are other interests that people have, and we have to stay connected and get ready for the next trip, because nobody wants to go out there and do a halfway show. I mean, like we're like Rush, like we're like Geddy and the guys were before we lost Peart, the drummer.
Yeah, Neil.
But we go as full tilt as they do. Like Rush.
Yeah.
It's in a different kind of a way, though.
Right, of course.
So in order to be that way, you got to be prepared. So you can't take your mind off it. And you got to think about your family. And you got to learn how to divide your time. And I don't know if I've learned how to do that yet.
Yeah.
How to divide my time really properly so that everybody can be happy with what you're doing. And you're not stepping on anyone's toes. And I try to get away with doing all this stuff without offending any members of my family.
It's got to be tricky.
Honestly, because not spending enough time or what they read about in interviews.
Sure.
You can get a close-in commentary from some of them. They'll give you a close-in, you know, attack, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
Things that they've read about themselves that I have said.
Right.
In interviews, and all I can say is, well, I'm sorry, and I've forgotten, I won't do it again, because they bring it up. And I do remember it. And a lot of, and when I'm making interviews now, I try to keep things up and up so when people close to me will not be offended by anything I might have said.
You feel a great responsibility not only to your family, but your band.
Yeah, and them too. And I don't talk about them enough like I don't talk enough about Ronnie Hawkins. Ronnie Hawkins is one of my very biggest benefactors. I don't talk enough about Ian Tyson and the people who got me started, Peter, Paul, and Mary, you know, got my career started. I was so lucky. I was just so, you know.
Further on up the road, someone gonna hurt you like you hurt me. Further on up the road.
John Donamy had a theory that it was Ronnie Hawkins' work ethic with the Hawks that inspired you to push your band as hard as you push your band.
You know, Ronnie's one of my very, he is such an unselfish, totally unselfish.
Funny guy, too.
Yeah. And he has helped more people, and me. He's promoted my stuff. He's recorded my songs. He's been I don't give him near enough credit, but he's one of my best friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you almost feel like you don't have to. We've got to hang out with Christofferson a couple of times together in the last 3 years, so at least we've had some time together.
Did his work ethic with the band inspire you? Was that something you saw?
You'd be there, sit there half the night listening to him, rehearsing them to go on the road with them. They became his road band.
Yeah.
So some of us got to do that.
You know, I heard that Ronnie calls you Gordonia.
Yeah, well, that, you're telling you, that's it, you know. That's it. That was it.
I'm a long ways from home, and I miss my loved one so. In the early morning rain, with no place to go.
What happens when Elvis sings one of your songs? What happens here?
Well, I was driving from Orillia, and I almost jumped out of the car when I heard it in the car bridge. I was only going to 80 miles an hour, though. I said, what? I said, really? I said, really? I was driving, and there it was at the car register, Elvis doing Early Morning Rain.
Yeah.
I said, I didn't even know that he'd done this, you know.
Yeah.
And then it sounded so good, and it was so well done, and I said, oh, my goodness gracious. And he does. He has a great version.
I have a fun memory. I was working at a radio station called Proud FM, which was an LGBT, gay, lesbian-focused radio station. Just, as you can imagine, a lot of dance divas, a lot of gay anthems, but also Gordon Lightfoot.
We're in there.
Stars on 54, Viola Wills.
Yes.
If you could read my mind, disco. That must have been a tremendous moment for you to all of a sudden be put through the bass and the, you know, the string sections and everything that they do in disco music, have your music in that format.
I hope they play her tonight. We're going to a benefit tonight. I hope that's the one that they might get her to use. The girl singer is going to be singing. I say, get the girl to listen to Viola Wills.
Yeah.
She's right on the internet. All you got to do is just ask for Viola Wills. And
right.
There it is. And also she used brass section on it that really worked well. It was early in the video. I think that if she had a bigger record company at the time, that could have been got some legs and made it right up the top of the chart.
Right. And it was the Stars on 54. They sort of did a cover of the Viola Wills one.
They had
as
43
well.
Minutes of it through the show.
Yeah.
They used it all the time. I was so proud. Mike Myers... He called my office to, like, I ran my own, had my own publishing.
That's years. Right. Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah.
To see if they could do it. And I said, well, go and listen to Viola Wilson. He said, it's a disco movie. Yeah, it's disco. Can we do it disco? I said, well, of course.
It's already been more or less done.
She did it.
Yeah, right. But I look at the names, Johnny Cash, as you said, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Glenn Campbell, Waylon Jennings, Diana Krall, Sarah McLachlan, Neil Young, Ian and Sylvia, Nico, the Grateful Dead, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Kingston Trio.
Kingston Trio.
Judy Collins.
Streisand. Liza Minnelli.
George Hamilton IV.
Marty Robbins.
I know, it's amazing. Johnny Cash. I find it amazing. I don't know why. Why are they doing this? It's why? What do they find, you know?
You've credited a great imagination for this. Is that fair?
That maybe it's the lyrics, you know, or something, because I always try to like keep that all straight, keep the lyrics all straight so they can understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a goal, you know, about them to understand what I'm saying.
If I could only have you near to breathe a sigh or two, I would be happy just to hold the hands I love on this winter's night with you.
You are with Art at the End of the World. My name is Mark Wigmore. We'll return with more music and stories with my guest, Gordon Lightfoot, in moments. You are listening to Art at the End of the World on the Zoomer Podcast Network. We return now to my conversation with the legend, Mr. Gordon Lightfoot.
Baby, step back. Baby, step back. Either step up or step.
When When I knew I was going to be talking to you, I started thinking about all the different times I've had run-ins with Gordon Lightfoot in my life, and that's been, you know, whether I've watched you on TV or picking up my first copy of Gord's Gold or what have you. My parents, of course, went to see you back in the 70s. But one of the memories I have is listening to Art Bell, Coast to Coast, on AM radio. He was on 300 radio stations, just passed away a couple of years ago. And at that point, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, he'd only ever had on a couple of musicians, because basically he talked about aliens, ghosts, and time travel, and that's what he did. So the only musicians I ever heard on that show were Steven Seagal, from a musical standpoint.
Yeah.
Crystal Gayle.
Yeah.
And you, Gordon Lightfoot, overnight for 3 hours talking to Art Bell. Do you remember that at all?
I remember. How could I possibly forget that? It came about, one of the members at the health club, Arthur Smith.
Okay.
This guy promoted skating events. He said, get in touch with Art Bell. You should do a show. So I told the record company about it. And I think they contacted them. And the next thing I heard, I was doing Art Bell.
It was so interesting. I remember that night he was playing your music, and he was playing If I Could Read Your Mind, and afterwards he played Commercial, and then If I Could Read Your Mind, and then he said, I love music. And that was his big line, very broad. But well, it was so fun to hear you on that.
I started listening to his show, and I...
Yeah, did you like that show?
Yeah, I said, my God, I said, this is like big time. Here's a guy, goodness gracious, it goes all over the country.
He did.
It goes, it was everywhere. And here I am, I'm on this show, and I really couldn't believe it.
Did he ask you about ghouls and ghosts and aliens on that show?
No, he talked about
only music.
Same as what it was like being in the music business.
Yeah.
Right now, the guy who took over from Nuri,
George Nuri,
he said,
yeah,
the one guy he'd love to get on there is Bob Dylan. He said that one night, I heard him say it.
So that's another memory I have of you, is being at the Songwriters Hall of Fame and being at the table next to you as you're talking to Leonard Cohen. You guys were enjoying a sparkling water or something like that.
That was the one here, darling. She was with me at the one in New York that we did. We got it for the American one.
I remember that, yeah.
A few years back, too.
And
we spent most of the time hanging out with Kenny Rogers.
Now, there's a guy who covered you.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, he wanted me on his TV show when they were doing it here in Toronto, and I was such a big shot at the time. I turned him down.
Oh, my goodness.
Rolling on the River, it was called.
All right. Of course, it was such a treat to watch you and Leonard have a little conversation.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. We spoke a few times.
And I know you've been, you know, had this relationship with Bob Dylan, and people often talk about the two of you together. But when I think about the way Bob Dylan was famous for writing, often they would say he would write, you know, a famous song that he wrote maybe in an hour. But Leonard Cohen was actually a real sculptor like you. The two of you guys would work for a long time on a song. So I sort of felt like maybe you were closer to Leonard in writing style than maybe Bob.
Well, they both took about, probably most of them took about, basically about the same amount of time, but there's always this one or two that happen real quick.
Right.
And there's been several of those, actually. Like, for instance, I had If You Could Read My Mind and Cotton Jenny, that's an one afternoon thing where everything is just about
pretty much done.
Just about pretty much done.
Yeah. Like George Harrison talked about, he would never leave a song. Once he started, he just had to finish it. Like he couldn't be halfway done.
Well, I had one that took 8 years.
So there goes that idea.
It was just how it started. It's the only one.
Yeah.
I wanted because it was a fun song and with a beat. And it was called The No Hotel. The No Hotel. And I finally got her done. And
I hear you like a toe tapper.
Yeah, we got our show is loaded with toe tapper.
A classic Gordon Lightfoot toe tapper.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
John Donaghy, I talked to him recently. He told me that he thought you had redone some of the lyrics to Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald at some point, once you knew a little more about the story. Is that true, that you took the editing pen to that song?
One spot.
Okay.
One spot. We had a ladies' committee in Madison, Wisconsin, and Reverend Ingalls and his son, a preacher attorney, an attorney preacher
okay.
son.
Right.
He was also a lawyer. And they were in charge of the Lutheran Church, the mission in Detroit, right by where the tunnel. But the ladies in the Madison, Wisconsin, did not like the lineup with the Edmund Fitzgerald because one of their members' sons, Ruth Hudson, was one of the deckhands who was supposed to be looking after the hatch covers at night.
Okay.
And one of the other women, Cheryl Rosman, now her foreman named Cheryl Cundy, her father Ransom Cundy, who was a bit older than Bruce, was the other deckhand who was supposed to be looking after the hatch covers.
Okay.
And after a while, meeting all the people through the years, it became a little blame game developed. And I had to answer to Ruth Hudson in particular on this. What can you do? I heard it discussed one day on a talk show, on a radio talk show.
That's how far it had taken off, yeah.
So I changed it, and I instead now, I looked at the time schedule. The ship sank at about 7:30 in the evening. I got the Coast Guard report, still at my house. So I said, we're into November. Are we on daylight saving time yet at that point?
Right.
And the perfect answer comes to me. So I lose the hatch covers instead of saying it. At 7 p.m., a main hatchway gave in.
When supper time came, the old cook came on deck saying, fellas, it's too rough to feed you. At 7 p.m., a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you.
On the radio station, they started saying, well, did he say caved in, or did he say...
They're really going after the technicalities, yeah.
And I said, that's it. And I got Ruth Hudson on the telephone, and she was longer with us, and I said, I know what we can do. I can change it for all the concerts that we do from this point on, and that was 20 years ago. And believe you me, I'm involved in this. I have a scholarship at the Maritime Academy of Traverse City. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
You know sailing.
I said, I'll change in all the shows, but I can't change the record. I'm sorry.
I already did Gord's Gold. I redid all those songs. I can't do this
one. So instead of saying, at 7 p.m., a main hatchway gave in, I said, at 7 p.m., it grew dark. It was them. Then I said, fellas, it's been good to know you. But there, I had to borrow a line from Woody Guthrie.
Okay.
Anyway, so I was able to leave that alone. I've always admitted that.
Right.
We never knew the song was ever going to do
anything. Of course.
It did.
Of course.
It was a complete, total shock to everyone.
Well, who would have expected it so long? And
they called me from L.A. about it just as I was getting off a canoe trip with the record company. And said, we have to edit it to get it on top 20 radio here in Los Angeles. It had climbed that far. What can we do to shorten it? I said, well, you can't very well start cutting the lines out of it, the story's
it's not going to make any sense, yeah.
And so what I did is I, well, we were coming driving home from Flin Flon, Manitoba, at the end of a canoe trip.
With L.A. on the phone.
Trick up with, you know, Flin Flon, you know, it's the home of, who was it came from Flin Flon, by the real famous?
Yeah, you're right.
It was lived in Parry Sound, but I think it was...
Flin Flon. It's definitely, well, right. It could be a hockey player.
Bobby Clark.
Okay. From Flin Flon?
Yeah. Right. So there was a hotel there. And he asked me to do the national anthem one time at the hockey game in Philadelphia. And he knew I was going to be there. And I said, I'm not going to. He said, not only am I a Canadian, but I'm a Leaf fan. And the next time I saw him was at an event in Montreal. Even the Prime Minister Mulroney was there.
Okay.
Bobby Clark wouldn't speak to me.
Because of the hockey thing.
Speak to me there. He came to my show. He came to hear us play when we played in Philadelphia one time, and he brought four of the other hockey players from the... And we'd all gone, and Pat Quinn was part of it, too. He was
good old Pat Quinn, good Irishman.
And we went back and had beer together at the hotel lounge after the show.
Yeah.
With all these guys. And Bill Barber had just broken his leg, and he was on had a great big cast in his leg, and he was on crutches. And there we all are, we all having beers with Bobby Clark.
Wow. How about that?
Not Bobby Orr, but there were two great players.
Yeah. Bobby Clark.
But Bobby Clark eventually became the manager, the full-time manager, and probably, I guess he still is.
It's always interesting to hang out with professional athletes. They're a specific breed, eh?
Well, we got to do some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to do some of that. Like we got to hang out with Larry, the guy who just got with the inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, came to our show with all his... Larry... Darling. Larry Walker,
okay.
With all his golfing buddies.
All right.
Came to see us about the last time we played in Florida, because our bus driver knew him.
Okay.
And he got a hold of this guy, and there's Larry Walker and all his golfing buddies, and their wives are all at the show.
Yeah.
At the meet and greet, and everything. Had a great time.
It was fun.
In the early morning rain, with a dollar in my head, with an aching in my heart, in my pockets full of sand, I'm a long way from home. Lord, I miss my loved one so. In the early morning rain, with no place to go.
I can remember hearing Early Morning Rain, and even though I hadn't had that exact experience, I understood the emotional experience. I understood where your head was at, and that was such a powerful transmission from you to me, you know, listening to that piece and feeling your despair, but also feeling your hopefulness. It's very, very powerful to be able to share that with people.
Well, thank you. That was at music school. One guy had a car. Two guys had cars.
Got to have the friend with the car.
I was in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I was 19 years old. Everybody in little town of Orillia.
Yep.
The heck is this guy trying to do by going to Los Angeles? And the school was in Hollywood. It was on Sunset Boulevard. And right. I read about it in Downbeat magazine, because of the many musical interests that I had during high school, jazz was one of them. And we used to get on the bus and come down to the jazz at the Philharmonic at Massey Hall, when I was only old enough to, not old enough yet to drive.
Right.
We would come down by bus to jazz at the Philharmonic, produced by Norman Granz, all famous jazz musicians. Miles Davis, I mean, there was hundreds. He had these people working all over the planet. It was called Jazz at the Philharmonic.
Right.
By the time I wasn't driving either. By the time we finished high school, we were reading a magazine called Downbeat magazine, and they advertised a school in L.A., and we went, my friend and myself decided to go there.
The usual Aurelia to Los Angeles cross country trip.
Hell, what the hell is he trying to do?
Right.
The people, the folks back home. I wanted to take the notation course.
Right.
Because I'd already learned how to write songs, but I couldn't write the music. And been told by visiting, when I was old enough to drive, after a visit to BMI Canada, which is the first place I ever went to when I came to Toronto to see what I could do about my songwriting, that you had to be able to write your own lead sheets and your own music and know the chord symbols in order to register it and the lyrics with the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and with the Archive Canada here in Canada. You had to register it with two to prove ownership.
Right.
You don't have to do that now.
Right.
All you got to do is send them a CD. But for the first 12 albums, 15, 14 albums, I had to hand write all the lead sheets. And I did that. I did it gladly.
Now, I think I saw the lead sheets in the movie.
They're very
beautiful. You did a lovely job.
I got so good. I got a job. It was the first job I got when I got back to Toronto.
Yeah.
I was just a copyist. That's what I'd learned at school. We only stayed there for two semesters. One of the things we wanted to do at the school, only two guys had cars, was to go out to Hermosa Beach to the lighthouse to see Shelley Mann and his men one time, and the other time was to go and see Stan Kenton, which is, that was
the thing.
Cat's Meow.
Yeah, yeah.
Days. And on the way out there, I remembered the Boeing 707 being introduced while I was in Britain in 1963, and seeing it flying over in the golf course, because the guys I was working with at doing the TV show that summer for the BBC, it was the summer just before Kennedy was assassinated, used to take me to play golf. And I saw these airplanes coming in. I said, what is that? That's the brand new, 707. And we would stop and watch them come in. Beautiful airplane they were. And I remember it was a cloudy day one day, and we were watching both taking and landing, because in those days at Los Angeles Airport in 1958, you could go anywhere all around the airport. There was no buildings. There was no hotels. It was like the story from Hollywood. It was like the movie. I was watching through a low overhang, a low ceiling, and all of a sudden I could hear one coming. I'd never seen one before. Boeing 707.
Sure.
All of a sudden, from about 250 feet up, one of them just dropped right out of the clouds. It just dropped. It looked like, sure, it landed. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It landed. And everything was safe and everything was good, and I never forgot that. Not so much the takeoff. I say big 707 set to go. So what I did is I got a day when I could envision that, so I called this. We called Air Canada, my office, to see if I could be let on the tarmac with a Super 8 camera, and they said yes, you may. So we went out to the airport in Malta, and all afternoon I stood with my watching airplanes leaving, coming in and leaving, whichever I wanted to be, because they let me go. God, they all gave me a Jeep, for God's sake, to get a.
Wow, they really treated you.
So I'm babysitting that 8-month-old son.
Yeah. Watching the jet planes.
And I'm back, now we're back in Toronto. And it's 4 years later. And that morning, my former wife, Brita, a Swede, I went to Scandinavia to marry her. Everybody thought I was nuts for doing that, too.
For marrying her or for going overseas?
For going to Scandinavia to do it. Yeah, I just praise it. I can't even think about it. But I'm getting so close to the end of this tale that. So she's given me a title. She used to get song titles for me. She would pick them out of magazines, and she didn't speak English. And she came over here to work for a business magazine when she was 21 years old, to work with a business machine company on very little English, and yet she learned to speak English real fast. She was a smart woman. She was about 25, and I was about 22, so that gave her a bit of it.
Yeah, she had an extra step on you there.
Yeah. So she's left me with the title, Early Morning Train. Here's a title for you. To write a song, you're always thinking about trains.
Right.
She doesn't hear too much about the going to out Hermosa Beach and to see Stan Kenton and watching to watch the airplanes landing in Los Angeles International Airport in 1958. You know, so I'll say instead of train, though, I'm going to say rain.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about the one coming in of the first of the enter was the one coming in of the out of the low ceiling. That's the first one I ever saw. And I started writing, and I wrote that song in 2 hours.
There you go. That was very Bob Dylan of you.
I had a special tuning up on my guitar, too. I had an open tuning on the third position in D open on my 12th string when I wrote that one. I had everything was right. I had the right guitar, the right key. I called my my manager in New York. He listened to it on the phone. And you know what he said to me?
What?
And we already had an album. And we'd already had two recordings on this song, one by Ian and Sylvia, one by Peter, Paul, and Mary. He said, "You'll never have to worry about money again, Gordon," he said.
Was he right?
He was right.
Out on the runway number 9, Big 707 set to go. I'm stuck here in the grass with a pain that ever grows.
I played it for him over the telephone, sitting up outside of the desk. I said, will you check this out? They called him his office, and I played it for him over the telephone. He said, "Gordon, you don't have to worry about money again."
It's a good story, Gordon.
To go dancing, would you like to go home? Would you like to go dancing? Would you like to go home? Would you like to go anywhere? Why not give it a try? Where would you like to roam? I just want to stay home. So we started working on this album a year and a half ago.
I've been listening to it, just thinking about everything that you put into it. I mean, it feels to me like just a great Gordon Lightfoot record, you know? Like, it felt very familiar to me. And yet, you've played with the language, you've played with the lyrics, done some nice sort of changes and updates for the times we live in, but at the same time, it just feels like very comfortable.
Well, thank you. And also, at the time, I thought about the Springsteen album, Nebraska.
Yeah,
the fact that that was a solo album, his band stood aside. But my guys, they were not at all offended by the fact that I was doing it this way. Originally, we were going to do it. We were going to take the stuff and do it all over again and just build it right up from the
right. Do the big studio,
the ground
all the guys,
up and the whole deal. But we're not getting any younger and so forth. And we got family, and we don't want to be driving back and forth down the Queen Elizabeth Way for 25 trips. Because we would record in Hamilton.
What was the choice for Hamilton? What was the thing?
Because Bob Deutsch is my engineer, and he's the guy I trust, and he's the guy I want to work with. So
he's in Hamilton.
He runs Grand Avenue Studio.
Yeah.
So we had that to take into consideration.
Did you have to hole up down there? Did you get a place and everything?
No. I was going back and forth down the old McDonald Cartier Freeway, as they called it back then. Now, it's the road to Niagara Falls. It's the Queen Elizabeth Way. I love Canada. I love Toronto. I love the Queen Elizabeth Way. You know, I do.
We're just a colony, as I often say to my British friends. I sang that to Richard Flohill the other day. We're just a colony.
Oh, Richard. Oh, my goodness. Oh, God. How's he doing?
He's very good. He tells me that even though you're around the same age, he doesn't work out nearly as much as you do.
Well, half of it is psychological, and I have to work on my psychology to get my show really good. I have to train myself, and the workout is 50% workout, and the other 50% is showing up.
Right, sitting down,
showing
down
up
to the table, yeah.
Showing up. For the workout is, and believe, I don't have it in my basement, and I don't. I have to belong to a health club.
Right.
I don't mind belonging to a health club. And I don't have to go to a job because I'm my own boss, although I'm always thinking, I'm always doing something. Get up in the morning and go down, have breakfast and go down and do it first thing almost every day.
Just get it out of the way.
Yeah, yeah. Almost every day.
Right, that's pretty good. That,
when I first started going, it was 1982, so I've been doing it for almost 40 years now. And well, really, I started in 1980, but I hadn't given up alcohol yet. People say, how can I possibly do this? That time I didn't. I went maybe twice a week for the first 10 years.
Right.
And then after
sort of where I am.
5 years, I started up to three times a week.
Yeah.
And I would get off the booze. And actually, when I got off the booze, I started going a lot more. And after about doing it for 23, 24 years, I said, hey, this is helping my vocal. I feel better about my singing. I'm getting more power out of my lungs. What's causing this? So I started going four or five times a week.
Right. Well, I'm a DJ for 4 hours a day, so I know exactly what you're talking about. You go for a swim or you go for something in the morning, and you just have a better vocal day. It drives me crazy if I have a bad vocal day.
They say, what do you do on the road? I don't do anything on the road.
You don't?
My lovely wife, Kim Dutt, my little wife, Kim, who is with us here today who, in the studio, travels with me.
Yep.
She's been traveling with me for eight years. And she works with my crew, and she's a wonderful asset. She helps the road manager. We do merchandising now. I said I'd never do merchandising. The road manager's looking after the merchandising. She's looking after me. She makes sure I get... sure, get fed.
Right. That's big on the road, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basic things like
that's
that.
But it's one of the things that you suffer from is bad food, lack of sleep, you know, not the right place to stay and all those types of things. It's been an honor to sit here and have a conversation and talk about some of these great people in your life and these stories and these songs. And thank you for allowing me to have this time with you, and congratulations.
I hope I didn't go too deep.
You can talk to your wife about that.
Oh my goodness. Darling, are we okay?
Yeah.
Thank you, Gordon.
Good with me.
Okay. Did I do okay?
Would you like to find someone? Would you like to pass by? Would you like to find someone? Would you like to pass by? Would you like to find anything? Why not give it a try? Would you like to stand by? I just want to be me.
There it is. Thank you, Gordon Lightfoot. The new album is Solo. You can find it where you love to stream and download music. Maybe pick up a hard copy. That would be a nice idea. I've been doing that lately. Very fun. The sound quality is always so much better, whether you enjoy it on CD or vinyl. Solo, the new Gordon Lightfoot record, available now. I also want to thank our wonderful sponsors over this last season, Crows Theater, crowstheater.com. Be sure to take in a show once the doors are open again. And Red Eye Media, thank you to Suzanne and the company for two seasons of support. Really, that is a huge deal. And thank you so much for being on board with this show. Thank you for listening. Thank you to you. We are in talks about a third season, so I'm hoping we get a chance to do that. You can listen to episodes at artattheendoftheworld.com, classicalfm.ca, and then wherever you subscribe to podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify, all available to you. My name is Mark Wigmore. Please do be safe and help others during this difficult time, and support local artists as best you can. Buy a record, stream a concert, help out with a GoFundMe page. We hope to be back. We'll speak to you then, and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.